I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. Our guest, psychologist Ronald Siegel, noticed a consistent theme with his patients, a painful struggle to feel better about themselves. He even noticed this in his own life. He says that most of us fill our days with what he calls self-evaluative thoughts, doubting, second-guessing, criticizing ourselves for not being a good enough spouse or partner or friend or parent or coworker, you name it. We end up comparing ourselves to others all the time and we come up short. Trying to constantly feel good about ourselves can be exhausting, even debilitating. It can keep us from developing authentic relationships with other people and even with ourselves. Ronald Siegel wrote about these very human habits in his book, The Extraordinary Gift of Being Ordinary, Finding Happiness Right Where You Are, and that's our topic for today's show. He's an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School, and he's been in private practice for more than 40 years. And Ronald Siegel, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're very welcome. So what is it about us human beings and even human nature that we are constantly comparing ourselves to other people?
Yeah, it seems to have pretty deep evolutionary roots. Evolutionary psychologists who study this kind of thing point out that if you were to go to the African savanna with a naturalist and go on a so-called safari, the naturalist would show you the same pattern over and over in groups of social mammals. There would be a group of, there would be a dominant male surrounded by literally a harem of reproductively promising females. And then over in the next field, there'd be a group of younger guys doing the species-specific equivalent of playing basketball or football, right, trying to get up the skills to be dominant. And there's hundreds of other examples of this in the animal world. There are species of crickets. If you put them together in a box, inside of really just a few minutes, they'll organize themselves into a dominance hierarchy. And little kids organize themselves into dominance hierarchies very, very soon once they're put in a group. So what's this about? Well, it turns out that individuals who are dominant or consort with those who are dominant can direct more resources to themselves, to their partners, to their kids, and their genes are more likely to get passed down. So whoever among our ancestors had the random mutation that made them interested in dominance actually wound up passing their genes down. So we've taken on those genes ourselves. They've been passed down to us. Now,
I can understand how that might serve our, you know, how the animal kingdom and maybe even our ancient ancestors. How does that serve us today?
Well, not well, because the problem is today we're constantly concerned with our social rank within our human primate troop. And the way that the concern with social rank shows up is concern with self-esteem, because we're not beating our chests necessarily and clubbing each other to show our dominance. But what we are doing is comparing ourselves to one another and thinking they're better than I am or I'm better than they are. And this kind of social comparison is deeply, deeply wired in our neurology.
In fact, you, in this book, talk about your own struggles with comparing yourself to other people, constantly looking at yourself and wondering whether you measure up. And you're someone versed in psychology, have been dealing with people for decades, and yet you still struggle with this.
Yeah, totally. The impetus for the book started about 10 years ago. I'm 72 now, so it was my early 60s. And I had spent decades, I happened to be involved in contemplative practices, particularly Buddhist meditation practices that have as their goal not to be totally self-preoccupied, and spent years as a therapist, had been in my own therapy, and you'd think that I would have developed something like a secure and stable sense of self. But to be honest with myself and with you, you know, I would notice my sense of self fluctuating constantly throughout the day. I'd have a therapy session with somebody that went really well. And I think, yeah, all these years of study and practice, I've become a well-oiled machine. I'm so helpful to the world as a psychologist. The next session, in which the person had a problem that was kind of remarkably similar to their presenting problem 15 years ago. And I think, you know, I'm not cut out for this. This is clearly not my calling. I should have been a mechanical engineer. So just noticing these fluctuations and thinking, well, after all this work, still these fluctuations, what's going on here? And even more importantly, is there anything we can do about it?
Well, I wonder whether, since we're constantly, apparently, and I can totally relate to what you're talking about there, constantly comparing ourselves to other people. But if everyone is doing that, is anyone really judging us? Are they so involved in judging themselves that we're engaged in this sort of faux self-evaluation?
Well, that's totally true. I mean, so many times we will go into a situation worried about what other people will think about us, and the reality is they're mostly
They
thinking
don't
about
care.
themselves.
Right,
Right.
exactly.
However, we do use one another as benchmarks for judgment. So that's part of what hooks us into this. For example, if I'm trying to keep my self-esteem afloat by thinking that I'm intelligent, I'm implicitly comparing myself to other people that I'm hoping are less intelligent than I am so that I can feel that I'm intelligent. So we are judging one another, but largely to try to keep our own self-esteem afloat.
But it sounds like you're saying we judge each other or compare ourselves to others and generally come up short. That perhaps it's the rare person that says, "Oh no, I got this guy beat."
Well, there's actually two patterns that we see a lot of. There's certainly a lot of us coming up short and feeling inadequate in some way, not good enough. And this is either comparing ourselves to others in our current life or comparing ourselves to some inner standard, something that we learned as a child or at another point in our life about how we should be. And we're feeling like, I'm not cutting it in that way. But sometimes we're feeling pretty good about ourselves. Sometimes we're on something of a self-esteem high. But the problem there is we remain stressed out trying to stay on top of our game. So really, as long as we're on the self-esteem roller coaster, we basically have two choices: to either be kind of stressed out to keep our game up, or feeling inadequate, like not cutting it in some way.
That gets me thinking about the voices, not the hallucinogenic voices in our head, but the voices that we use to talk to ourselves, largely about ourselves. And I often wonder, so who's that person talking to me? I mean, is it my mother saying, "Clean up your room," or "I wish you'd gotten a better grade"? Who are the voices talking in our heads?
Well, I think you're on the right track. I think often they are internalized voices of people that we've been with in our lives, sometimes specifically a parent, if it's something from childhood. But then there are all sorts of voices and messages that we absorb from the culture. For example, the message that only losers feel anxious, or if you feel sad, you must be a loser. There are all of these messages that we get that block us off from the full range of human feeling. And it's probably not that somebody told us that, although some perhaps they did, but we've just absorbed it from the culture around us.
And made it part of our identity, a part of our sort of worldview that we've got these largely negative voices in our head.
Yeah, and we think of them as real and sometimes as inviolate. I think of a patient of mine who was brought up by a dad who was pretty self-centered and was very much in the dog-eat-dog world, and you've always got to be on top, and you should never apologize, and you should, show your power. And, for him, it took a really long time to realize that this was not actually the nature of the universe. This is the nature of messaging that he received over and over and over again. It takes a very long time sometimes to notice that, oh my gosh, that's a thought, that's a message, that's not actually in the nature of things.
I wonder about the difference between, if I can call it, toxic self-criticism, or the kind of self-criticism that isn't healthy, and the kind of self-criticism. And I would assume, as a therapist, I mean, we need to be self-critical. We need to be able to evaluate whether we're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. How do you see those differences?
Well, this is actually a somewhat subtle matter because we can evaluate ourselves. Let's say right now I'm in the interview with you
Right.
and I'm thinking about whether I'm sufficiently articulate or not, or am I giving you an engaging answer and something that the audience is going to resonate to. To have a voice evaluating that is sensible, right? I want to do a good job in the interview. I want this to be useful to you and your listeners. However, to have my sense of worth hanging on that, to have my sense of being inflated, like, oh, I feel so good about myself, I'm the brilliant professor, or oh, I'm over the hill, I can't think straight anymore. To have that be the major theme, that actually gets in the way. So evaluating in the sense of having discernment over what's best to do, or even, should I climb Everest this afternoon? Probably not. I'm not in shape for that. Should I do brain surgery? No, I'm not a good candidate. To understand our abilities, super important for living life well. But to have it reflect to us and to others on our self-worth, well, that actually is not so helpful.
Is that the goal of therapy, which is to sort of detangle some of these criticizing voices?
Yeah, well, therapy can be enormously helpful for this. There's been a lot of research lately on something called self-compassion, right? And this researcher was it was found, the leader in this was Dr. Kristen Neff, who's at the University of Texas in Austin, and she pointed out that when we mess up, when we feel bad about ourselves in some way, we get stuck in three things. We get super self-critical. In fact, we talk to ourselves in ways we would never talk to another human being. And I do this all the time. You idiot,
Of
what were you
course.
thinking? I don't talk to
Guilty.
family or
Yes.
I wouldn't have any family or friends or colleagues if I talked to other people this way, right? So these self that's kind of we and we also isolate from others, and we get very caught in these thoughts. And that kind of thinking is very much built in. But we can do something about it. We can actually be kind to ourselves instead of beating ourselves up. And that's a skill that we can learn. So I think most therapies do move us in this direction of how to be kind to ourselves when we mess up.
And that self-critical voice is so interesting, and I again can totally relate to that. The voice that is so harsh, as you say, we would never say that to another person, but maybe because we live with ourselves, we feel entitled to say it to ourselves.
I think we feel entitled to say it to ourselves, and many of us have the fantasy that if only I were harsh with myself, then I'd improve. So if I condemn myself for eating that piece of chocolate cake, maybe I won't eat it the next time. If I hate myself for getting a low grade on the test, maybe I'll study harder. But the research literature, which is very extensive about self-compassion, shows actually that doesn't work. That when we beat ourselves up, all we want to do largely is avoid the whole realm. Like, oh, I never want to take another math test. Whereas if we can be kind to ourselves and soothing to ourselves, and really with a deep sense of, I like to think of it as channeling Mr. Rogers, it's okay, sweetheart. Won't you be my neighbor? If we can generate that for ourselves in these moments of criticism, then we're much more resilient. We can bounce back because we feel like we have the resource. Like, okay, I can mess up, I can fail, but I can also find love and care for myself so I can come back up and do it again. I'm not overwhelmed by my self-esteem collapses.
And we're taking a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Dr. Ronald Siegel. And we're talking about a book he wrote a couple of years ago, The Extraordinary Gift of Being Ordinary. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we are talking about, instead of focusing on self-improvement and comparing ourselves to others all the time, how about a little self-acceptance? And again, our guest is psychologist Ronald Siegel. He's an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School, and he's been in private practice for many decades. I do want to dig into kindness, but I also want to ask you about social media. We've been talking about comparing ourselves to others, and I think of social media as this great comparison machine, that constantly sort of both pulls us in and makes us feel uncomfortable or even badly about ourselves. How do you see that relationship?
Yeah, I'm afraid that selfie esteem has become really
Right.
quite a problem for any of us on social media. The typical post on social media is not woke up this morning, had the runs again because I'm anxious, afraid I'm going to get a bad performance review at work, and my partner's going to leave me. No, it's like here I am in a fantastic place, doing fantastic things in a curated picture, and you weren't invited.
Exactly.
It's I often think that if we were nation states, it would be as though we were reading our own crime and poverty statistics while looking at other people's travel brochures. And it's just a setup for feeling horrible about ourselves. And I think it's particularly painful for young people. I remember sitting home on a Saturday night sometimes as an adolescent and wondering where the other kids were. And okay, I'll watch TV, with my parents. That's okay. But now if you're sitting home alone and you're seeing everybody else in curated feeds about the things you weren't invited to, how painful.
And yet we keep getting drawn back into the algorithm.
And this is in part because self-esteem is so addictive. If we just take a moment to remember a time when we had a self-esteem boost, felt good about ourselves and how that feels in the body. And at least for me, I'm sitting up tall and my chest is a little bit expanded and I feel lovable and strong and all that compared to a self-esteem collapse where it's like if I was a dog, I'd have my tail between my legs and it feels horrible. Whenever there's such a strong difference between something that feels so good and something that feels so bad, we're ripe for addiction. So what happens is maybe we get likes on social media, or we get followers, or get comments that we enjoy, and we start to feel good about ourselves. And then when they go away, we start to feel bad about ourselves. So then we desperately need more of them. So this keeps us addicted. The whole when Mark Zuckerberg came up with the idea of having people like or not like something, that was the engine that made social media work, because people will, just like the rats in a Skinner box pressing the bar for the pellet, we will do all sorts of things for that dopamine hit that we get in our nervous system for, oh, they like me.
Is that why, and you're sort of a critic of some of these self-esteem programs? I remember they were very much a part of school systems a number of years ago, saying, well, if you feel better about yourself, you'll do better in math. And perhaps it's the self-esteem that creates this roller coaster of the highs and the lows.
Unfortunately, and I'm a psychologist, and it's my profession that really blew it here. Starting in the 1980s, there's a big funded project in California. The idea was let's raise the self-esteem of kids who might go into gangs or might get pregnant earlier than they're ready to have a child. And if we raise their self-esteem, it'll be a social vaccine, and these things won't happen anymore. Huge funded program. Miserable failure because they got the causal arrow wrong. Yes, when kids do well in school or in sports, they do tend to feel better about themselves, and kids in gangs or early pregnancy don't feel good about themselves. But it's not that you can raise the self-esteem to get the kid to feel good about themselves. You have to help kids to engage in life in a meaningful and wholesome way, and then they'll feel good about themselves. So all of the participation awards and the yes, everyone's a winner has just served to hook kids on this dimension and think that this is the pathway to well-being. It's been a miserable failure.
You even question happiness, and you know, this is the anniversary, the 250th anniversary of the founding of this country, written into our Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You write in this book that we humans didn't evolve to be happy. How come?
Because the brain evolved for survival and reproduction, so that we have all of these different systems, one of which is this system we're talking about, right? To be concerned with how we compare to one another and to try to come out on top. That does not yield happiness. It was good for becoming dominant or consorting with the dominant ones and passing on our genes, but it is not good for well-being. And there are many others, like our fight or flight system, which is so well equipped to help us in emergencies, but is always stuck on because of our ability to think. So many of us are anxious. Look how much difficulty we have sleeping. Dogs don't have that kind of difficulty sleeping, but so there's all sorts of propensities of the brain that, yeah, they were really good for survival, but they leave us pretty unhappy. However, it's not a firm sentence. We really can do things to counteract these. There are antidotes to these things, but we need to understand what are the propensities that make us miserable and not just continue to reinforce them by doing the behaviors that keep us stuck in them.
Well, let me just dig a little deeper into happiness, which you describe. I mean, you're not the only one, but this is often how it's divided, which is excitement or hedonia. That's the sort of pleasure of the moment that makes us feel happy. And there's eudaimonia, which is the state of well-being, a very different kind of happiness. Tease those two apart.
Absolutely. There's been this field of positive psychology, actually mostly started in your town at the University of Pennsylvania by Marty Seligman and Chris Peterson and others, that was really trying to say, look, psychology up until now has been, can we get from negative 10 to zero, right, on the scale of well-being? Is there anything better possible? So they started really investigating this. And at first they thought, yeah, well, it's about pleasure. Let's help people have more of these pleasurable states in which we feel good about ourselves, including the self-esteem boost that we just talked about. Oh, how can I feel like a success? That would feel good. And over time, in really studying it, they realized they were barking up the wrong tree. And actually, happiness, pleasure's great,
Well,
but
sure.
happiness is not mostly about pleasure. It's mostly about other things, such as meaning and connection and using and being present to our experience. And it turns out that these are the very things that are effective antidotes to being stuck on the self-esteem roller coaster.
Meaning that happiness is a byproduct of our relationships or this finding of meaning in our lives.
Exactly. And these things aren't necessarily pleasurable in the moment. If I'm sitting with a friend who is ill, or even with a friend who is dying, and I am really connected to that friend, it's not exactly pleasant. It's quite painful. There's all sorts of sadness. But if I'm feeling connected in that moment, it feels deeply meaningful and deeply fulfilling. So it's this shift from how can I get high? How can I get a pleasant feeling to how can I have meaningful connections in the world becomes so important for our overall well-being.
Which are much more long-lasting than that pleasure hit.
Much more long-lasting. My friend and colleague Bob Waldinger is the runs the Harvard Study for Adult Development. It's the longest-running study on human well-being. They started in 1938. And he will tell you the jury is in. We now know what's most important for well-being, and it's the quality of our relationships. People who feel that they're in connected relationships, and particularly relationships where they can trust one another, they thrive physically and psychologically. When we have less of that, we don't thrive as much. But the thriving is not always about pleasure. It's about this feeling of meaning and connection.
What does it mean to embrace ordinariness? And I have to say, I mean, I like the title of your book very, very much, but I also struggled, I think, like a lot of us, with this word ordinary, because it can mean boring or, just not
Yeah,
particularly interesting. So let's dig into that.
you could imagine when I was asking friends and colleagues, doing a little focus group, looking for a title, I got a lot of, nobody's ever going to buy a book about ordinariness. Everybody wants to
Exactly.
be special.
Indeed.
And it's true, but the being special is about being hooked on the highs of the self-esteem roller coaster. I mean, that if we really examine it, if we notice what's going on in our hearts and minds and bodies in a moment when we feel special, it's I'm special, others aren't. It's really about this basic competitive drive that is so deep in our neurology, and it's getting activated. Whereas ordinariness is about developing common humanity, a sense of common humanity. I mentioned Kristin Neff's work about self-compassion. So the first piece is let's have as an antidote to the brutal self-criticism, just being kind to ourselves in some way. The antidote to withdrawing, because when we screw up, we don't want to, we feel shame, we don't feel like we should be part of the human family, and we tend to withdraw to try to not be seen. The antidote to that is noticing common humanity. That's the experience that we all screw up. We all have successes and failures. We all have disappointments. This is part of what it is to be human. And when we can settle into that very ordinary experience, we're so much better off. We're so much less stressed out, and we're so much better able to connect to others because we can have honest conversations and say, oh, you feel insecure about that? Oh, I feel insecure about something similar. Let's share our experiences instead of let's posture. You know, one of the chapters of the book is called Make a Connection, Not an Impression.
Right.
And that line resonates for me a lot because so often in life, we're trying to impress people. Whereas if we could connect to people instead, we would feel quite ordinary, but quite good.
Well, you also say that embracing our ordinariness, it also helps us to forgive, maybe forgive others, but also forgive ourselves. How so?
Totally. Well, this is about coming to grips with all of the different parts of ourselves, including the parts of ourselves we don't like. Right? We all have parts of ourselves that we'd love to showcase, and others that, Carl Jung called it our shadow, right? Parts that we don't like. So, you know, I don't like my selfishness. I don't like when I feel uncool. I could give you a really long list, right? When we're constantly trying to push those things out of awareness, when we're constantly trying to prove that that's not who I am, I'm really the good stuff, then we reject these parts of ourselves. And when we see these parts of ourselves in others, we reject them. So if, for example, I hate the fact that I get anxious and I see somebody else who's looking anxious and insecure, I'm going to think, what a dork, what an anxious and insecure person they are. I'm going to judge them negatively. But if I can make friends with the fact that, yeah, part of my humanness is I'm an anxious human, and I see someone else who's anxious, I'm much more likely to want to befriend them in some way and say, oh yeah, I know what that's like, and connect. The more we can settle into not needing to be special, the more we can make these connections. And in these moments of connection, the whole self-esteem thing falls away. If I'm talking honestly with a good friend about my experience, I'm not even thinking of me as a separate me. I'm thinking of us as a we and enjoying the connection.
And that's our guest today on The Connection, I should say, is Ronald Siegel. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago, The Extraordinary Gift of Being Ordinary, Finding Happiness Right Where You Are. And that is what we are talking about today on the show. He's been in private practice for many years, and he's also an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. And you're listening to The Connection right here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I want to pick up on when you talk about the shadow so that I want to make sure our listeners understand what you mean by that. And what was it Jung who talked about our shadow, the sort of darker parts of ourselves? And I think, you know, when you get to know yourself, you get to take a look at those parts. And sometimes that's difficult, and it might not be something you want to share with another person. How do we embrace the dark part of ourselves?
Well, here's where mindfulness practice or other contemplative practices can be really, really helpful. To get involved in some practice in which we're actually watching what's happening in the mind. The mindfulness practice, for example, it's been a big part of my work, is about being aware of present experience with loving acceptance. And most people are familiar with different forms of meditation where you might pay attention to the breath or a mantra or looking at a candle or something like this. And when we do this, not for the purpose of stilling the mind, but for the purpose of paying attention to notice what arises in the mind, we start to notice all of these thoughts and feelings that are happening during the day, including all of the thoughts and feelings that we're not so proud of. So I notice my greed more often, or I notice my fear more often, or I notice my confusion more often. I notice these things that aren't the most noble qualities that we want to advertise when showing off in the world. And the more we can see them, and the more we can take a kind and compassionate attitude toward them and realize that they are essential parts of our common humanity, because everybody has these parts in themselves. The more we can do that, the more we can settle into ordinariness, and we become not only more accepting of ourselves, but we become so much more accepting of other people.
How do we do that without being critical, without judging? I mean, having those thoughts and feelings and memories possibly going by and looking at them dispassionately. How do we do that?
Well, we start by just noticing them. And when we notice how often we're caught, for example, in the self-esteem roller coaster, for me, I open my email and virtually every email is like either makes me feel a little better or a little worse about myself. I get the email from your producer inviting me to the show, and I think, oh, great, I'll be on WHYY. That'll be nice. I'd love to share these understandings with folks. I get another email where I see, oh, there's this conference I wasn't invited to. Oh, I'm, you know, the opposite's happening. Just noticing this begins to free us up from it, because we start to realize this is nuts. This is really crazy to be going through our day with this happening all the time. And the other thing that happens when we notice it is we notice how unwinnable this game is. It's unwinnable for two reasons. One is we recalibrate. So the things that once floated our boat don't do it anymore, right? Remember the toy we probably both had as kids where you put the concentric sized discs on a pole, and they're supposed to look like a colorful cone or Christmas tree at the end. You know, there was a time where that floated my boat as a little kid. I still have a visceral memory of that. Doing it this afternoon probably wouldn't float my boat in quite the same way. Maybe in a few years, you know, in the skilled nursing facility, I will feel proud of doing that again. But we start to realize that things that once worked don't work anymore. You know, oh, wow. You know, I'm able to rent an apartment. Well, that did it then, doesn't do it now. So we start to see how we keep recalibrating, we keep needing more and more to feel good enough. And then we notice that what goes up goes down. So, you know, even if we're an Olympic gold medalist, what's the chance of winning the gold in 4 years, in 8 years? And we age, we get ill, we start to actually notice how this all works. That helps us. That helps us to let go, because we start to realize that this isn't working for us.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Ronald Siegel, our guest today on The Connection. We are talking about the extraordinary gift of being ordinary, the topic of a book he wrote just a couple of years ago. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, our guest is psychologist Ronald Siegel, and we have been talking about why we believe we're never good enough and what to do about it, why being special is overrated, and how mindfulness can help us deal with some of the difficult feelings that we keep buried from ourselves and from other people. And again, he wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Extraordinary Gift of Being Ordinary, Finding Happiness Right Where You Are. Let me ask you a little bit about, this is not a political question, but just that we live in a country that really prizes specialness. You know, we look out for number one, we're told to reach our full potential, self-improvement, bootstraps, all the things that are really part and parcel of what it is to live in America. How do you see that in contradiction to what we've been talking about?
Well, we do live in a particularly individualistic culture here in America. The countries vary from one to other. Ethnic groups vary and the like. And the emphasis on individualism does tend to lead us to a lot of social comparison, and a lot of wondering, how am I doing? Am I successful enough? And metrics for success, such as earning a lot of money or having power or that sort of thing, that really does tend to hook us on the self-esteem roller coaster. I mean, we can get hooked on it in terms of, am I as generous as I should be? Am I as kind as I should be? But when we live in a culture where those values are being emphasized more and are being praised and rewarded more, it tends to work out better than when it's just, you know, power, money, status, and the like. So it is very hard when we don't get a lot of cultural support for being ordinary. I mean, you look at things like conspicuous consumption, you know, the way that people will buy all sorts of fancy things in order to show other people that they can buy them. It's really quite sad, and it's quite pervasive in our culture.
Well, when they do those happiness index and they look at from one country to another, it tends to be Finland, you know, the more Scandinavian countries that come out on top, U.S. sort of in the middle there. But at the same time, we've got this happiness thing as part of our Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, well, we have many different instincts in us, but two of the competing instincts, one is this quest for dominance or winning or being on top. We also have instincts toward cooperation, right? It was very important for our ancestors on the African savannah to hunt together, to warn one another of danger, to share food. You know, if I bring home a wildebeest this week, but it's more than I can eat or my family can eat, I share it with you and you do the same with me. So we have strong instincts that way as well. And one of the things we know about what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity is that whatever we practice, the way it's, neurobiologists talk about it, is that the neurons that fire together wire together. So they will fire together if we practice something. So the more we practice a given attitude, the more that attitude becomes natural for us. So we actually can try to shift our behavior and practice more of the kinds of behaviors that are going to emphasize this cooperative, connective energy rather than the competitive ones. But it's rough in a culture that's giving us a lot of messaging that says, if only you could buy this vehicle, then you'd be happy.
Well, in fact, you say we're more bonobos than we are chimps. I mean, bonobos being, well, first of all, they're kind of female-led groups, but at the same time, based on a more cooperative style of relationship.
Indeed.
And yet, we live in a country that I think thinks it's a chimpanzee.
Well, you know, again, it's whichever neurocircuitry we activate more is what we get more of. And if we grow up in a society that is very much emphasizing the competitive dog-eat-dog kind of nature, and, you know, there's something to free market economies. I'm not arguing for other social organizations. They're problematic in their own way, but free market economies do bring this up. I mean, you know, the degree to which kids in high school, the number of kids who now want to be an influencer as their goal in life, because look at all the status, money, and attention influencers get. To me, that's kind of sad.
I wonder a little bit more about mindfulness, whether we use it to feel better about feeling bad about ourselves. But at the same time, you talk about the importance of when you feel it, you heal it. Or I guess another way to put it is when you name it, that you tame it. And this idea of looking at the parts of ourselves that we might not be so proud of and how we can own them and make them less scary or less toxic.
Absolutely. You know, every time we have a self-esteem collapse in our current life, it tends to resonate with some kind of self-esteem collapse we had before that was painful and where we never fully resolved the trauma of it. I'll give you a very simple example.
Sure.
I was speaking at a conference, and there's a social hour with presenters, and there are a group of people who are very well known in my field who were all talking together. And I suddenly had this feeling of insecurity about sort of moving into the conversations, sort of joining the group, inserting myself in the group. And when I had this feeling, I felt the anxiety, and I took a moment to say, and it was a kind of self-esteem, I'm not good enough feeling. And I said, what does this feel like? And I immediately flashed on being a little kid with my older brother, where he and his friends generously allowed me to kind of follow along with them, but I definitely wasn't quite part of the group. When I was able to feel that, the kind of pain of that, that I had as a little kid, then it was like, oh, this is that. I know that feeling. That's an old feeling. I can feel that feeling and go join the group anyway. And I did. And it was a lovely evening there. They're very gracious. It was a very nice group of people. That kind of thing. And here it's the mindfulness practice that allows us to notice, oh, there's this feeling arising. What is this feeling? Not to just be caught in the thought loop of, oh, they're not going to like me or whatever, or this is going to feel awkward, but to actually notice what's happening in the body, connect with it, and be able to open to it and realize, okay, this particular self-esteem challenge at the moment is actually a little opportunity to heal the unresolved trauma, if you will, or the pain from this thing that happened earlier in my life. And when we orient that way, we become so much freer because we don't have to become afraid of failure so much. Every time there's a failure, it's going to be an opportunity to work something through. It's going to be an opportunity to heal some residual piece of past unresolved pain. So again, it helps us to not be always grasping for the success to feel better, but to actually use the moment of failure to grow and develop.
How important is breathing, not just to mindfulness, but just to living? I remember taking an acting class and being told, you're not breathing, you know, which is, and I wonder, I mean, we've been talking about mindfulness, but we've been also talking about just being a human being, whether we should pay more attention to our breath.
Well, when we're paying attention to our breath, we're doing two things. One is we're regulating our nervous system, which is helpful because when we're frightened, we're like, you know, we're short, shallow breath. And when we're not frightened, we have longer, deeper breaths. And if we change the breath, we'll actually become somewhat less frightened. So we regulate the nervous system. But the other thing that paying attention to the breath does is it brings our attention from the thought stream where we're living so much of the time, where we're thinking, you know, oh, am I good enough? What should I do? How can I impress them? All these kinds of thoughts into just being present. Just feeling what's actually happening in the present moment. It doesn't have to be the breath. It's really when we turn our attention to any sensory object in the present, it can help us to step out of this thought stream a little bit and notice what's going on emotionally underneath.
I find that really hard to do, which is just to sort of let things kind of flow through and paying attention, but not being judgmental. I'm sure I'm not alone in that, but just...
You're not alone.
No. I mean, and sometimes it just feels so crowded up there of just the jumble of thoughts and feelings and memories.
Sometimes mindfulness practice starts with just noticing all the judgmental thoughts tumbling one after the other. It can be disturbing to actually notice what's going on in our minds rather than distracting right. ourselves from it. But ultimately, it becomes very, very fruitful because it allows us to more and more accept ourselves as the confused mammals that we are.
And acceptance just sort of lets it be okay, I guess.
Totally. You mentioned that I've been a psychotherapist for many years. So many people come into psychotherapy with the fantasy that I'm going to get a whole new personality, right? I won't have to be Ron anymore who has these insecurities. I'll be able to be strong like this person or entrepreneurial like that person or et cetera. And when therapy goes well, what happens is the person is still pretty much themselves at the end of a period of therapy, but they've become friends with that person. Mm. They now actually like being the somewhat nutty, somewhat symptomatic person that they were before, but now they're friends with them, and it makes it an entirely different experience. There's just study after study that shows the more we can be friendly toward ourselves and actually see ourselves as lovable, even if we're far, far from perfect, the better we do in life.
Is it a matter of telling a different or maybe even better story about ourselves, or is it just more about acceptance?
It's really more about acceptance. Look, in psychotherapy, it starts by the fact that most therapists aren't super judgmental. And they listen to us with interest and curiosity with, oh, I wonder how you became the particular person you became. What's this about? What's going on here? And simply having that kind of attitude helps, because instead of it being, oh my God, I'm so ashamed, I'm so bad in this way, I'm so broken in that way, it all starts to become something that we can become interested in and curious about. And interest and curiosity, as opposed to self-evaluative judgment, becomes a really useful tool and posture to start saying, well, maybe this all is okay.
This may be an unfair question, but I feel, especially with our conversation, the need to ask you about our country. And if we are a family, maybe a dysfunctional family, how you see our country, and it's not like we haven't had hard times before or very divisive times or really difficult times, but as a psychotherapist, what you see going on, and is it, if we name it, can we tame it? If we feel it, can we heal it?
Well, it's very hard. And of course, wherever we are in the political spectrum, we see this very differently. But one thing that certainly is happening is, I'll just talk about the left and the right broadly. They're both seeing the other as very bad, very dangerous, and not human like me. And this is very problematic, right? The fact that we don't see one another as we're the human beings who disagree, but we see one another as threatening bad others. And, throughout human history, one of the things that happens is we project our shadows. We project the parts of us we don't like onto the bad others. So, the Nazis saw the Jews as dishonest and greedy and sexually promiscuous and all this kind of thing. And you see this in every group looking at other groups about how they're bad. And in our current political situation, we see ourselves as rational and clear and knowing the facts. And the people on the other side, well, they're clearly irrational, crazy, driven by their emotions and not very smart. And both sides see the other side that way. And this is quite tragic, because it's in part everybody's building up their self-esteem by looking down at the other side. And we have this as a national project rather than seeing ourselves as all human, all ordinary, all struggling to try to find some sort of well-being as a confused mammal, which is kind of more of what I think is the case.
And that's Ronald Siegel, our guest today on The Connection. He wrote a book called The Extraordinary Gift of Being Ordinary, Finding Happiness Right Where You Are. And you're listening to The Connection right here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I wonder whether, based on what you were saying about our divided country, and clearly we are, and I'm sure both people on both sides of that argument feel like, well, the truth is on my side. I mean, that there, and sometimes there is an objective truth, and then there are subjective truths. How do you personally wrestle with that?
Well, one of the findings in cognitive psychology over the last 20 years or so, it has two aspects to it. One of them is we are all extremely irrational as beings. In other words, our emotions really lead our thoughts, and the thoughts, many of our thoughts are designed to, well, Ben Franklin put it brilliantly. Ben Franklin said, "What a wonderful thing man's reason is, because it allows him to make up a reason for anything he's got a mind to do." Well, this is the finding of cognitive psychology, that this is the case. And the other thing is that we all believe we're rational actors. We all believe that we're objective and the other person is irrational. So that's it puts us in quite a pickle. Now, this isn't to say we shouldn't believe any of our thoughts. Obviously, we have to make decisions in the world. We have to make judgments. But I think to have humility about it and to really watch what's going on emotionally in each moment is helpful. Like if I'm having a thought about a political matter or a psychological model or whatever it might be, and I feel a lot of energy behind it, like, oh, I'm defending this. I feel like I need to defend this. I let a little bell go off in my mind and say, what's this actually about for you? And are you having difficulty even considering the other side because something's gripped you here? And I think if we can notice our emotional involvement in it, it gives us a little bit of a better shot at, we're not going to find objectivity, but we'll at least be able to consider the other side.
Almost out of time here, but do you see our country capable of doing this? Maybe not today, but at some point.
One hopes. I mean, you know, human beings have all these competing instinctual and motivational systems in them. And sometimes one set is more activated and sometimes another set is more activated. And, you know, one set that gets called our better angels, right, is when the urge toward cooperation, toward altruism, toward compassion is being more activated, and people are seeing that in one another, and it encourages each of us to express that. Sometimes it's more this dog-eat-dog, who's-on-top, dominance-oriented set of instincts, and then that's what's modeled, and that's what becomes activated. Unfortunately, we are in a phase where the latter is being much more activated, and we see it in many, many realms.
My hope is that
we'll move in the other direction.
Got it. Ronald Siegel, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And again, his book is called The Extraordinary Gift of Being Ordinary, Finding Happiness Right Where You Are. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us as well.